Hello. I'm with my good and dearest friend and fellow Spurs supporter, Paolo Hewitt. And we're going to have a little conversation here. Or as we should say, a picture paints a thousand words, but no one can paint Paolo's words. So here we go. What we're going to do is we're just going to have a little brief chat about his humble beginnings.
Okay.
And his being a music critic and a best-selling author. So how did you start with your music beginnings, I should say?
Okay, well, it all began when I was 14 years old. I was living in Woking. I was at a school called St. John the Baptist. And I walked into the common room, and a friend of mine, Enzo Esposito, also from Naples, was reading a copy of The Enemy, and I'd never seen The Enemy before. And I was like, "What's that you're reading?" And he said, "Oh, it's the New Musical Express." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "It's a paper about music." And I said, "What are you on about?" And he said, "It's a paper about music." I said, "What, just about music?" Because I'd never seen such a thing. And he got really annoyed with me and said, "Oh, just read it." And I started reading it, and the light bulb went up, and I thought, that's what I want to do in life. Because at that point in my life, I was really into music and I was really into books. So there's The Enemy brought both together. So when I was 19, 20... I just had that in my mind the whole time. It was just like, that's what I'm going to do, that's what I'm going to do, that's what I'm going to do. I used to buy The Enemy religiously and blah, blah, blah. And then when I was about 19 or 20, I thought, I need to leave Woking because they have bylaws against you being a writer down there in Woking.
I can totally understand why you'd leave Woking.
Yeah. Okay. So, no offence. So I came to London. I got into North London Poly at Kentish Town, and the first thing I did was to sign up for the student newspaper. And I used to do reviews for them and, you know, write album reviews or interview bands that came to play the college. And then one day, the great thing about moving to London was that you could buy The Enemy on a Tuesday lunchtime at Camden Town tube station. And I was like in my... Because you couldn't get it till Thursday afternoon in Woking.
I remember those days, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just like, wow, this is great. So every Tuesday lunchtime, straight down to Camden. Anyway, I go down there one week and I say to the guy, "Can I have The Enemy?" And he goes, "We've sold out." And I said, "What do you mean you sold out?" He said, "We sold out." I said, "Well, you must have some more copies." "No, we ain't got any more copies." And I spent about 10 minutes driving this guy. And I'm like, "Well, come on." He's like trying to get a fix. "You know, you've got to give me my fix, man. I've got to get my Enemy, you know." And in the end, I thought, if I can't have heroin, I'll buy methadone. I bought Melody Maker, right? Which was like, Melody Maker was kind of like for the old people. We had Led Zeppelin and all that. Whereas Enemy was much more up to date. Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, all the new wave stuff and whatever. So I got home and I opened it up, and there was an advert, Young Writers Wanted. I thought, oh, okay. So I cut out stuff I'd done for the college paper, put it in an envelope, sent it off to Melody Maker. That was the Tuesday. Thursday, I got a phone call. "Hi, this is so-and-so at Melody Maker. Would you like to come in for an interview on Friday night with the editor, Richard Williams?" I was like, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, come in." So I went down there to Waterloo, and I met an editor called Richard Williams, and he said, "Come into my office." And I went into his office and I sat down, and above his head on the wall was a picture of the Italian football team from 1970. And I went, "What, do you like football?" And he went, "Yeah, I do like football." And we spoke about football for half an hour, and I got some freelance work out of it.
He wasn't Italian, was he?
No, he wasn't, but he was really into... He loved Luigi Riva. He loved Riva.
Fair play.
Yeah, so... So from there, I started writing live reviews, and then Melody Maker went on strike. And when they came back, a few of the writers had left, and they offered me a job on the Melody Maker. So I left college and I started writing for Melody Maker, which was 1980. And that lasted till 83, and then I joined the NME.
Yeah, it's like going from the Championship to the Premiership.
Yeah,
here, obviously.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Although, to be honest with you, I was much happier at Melody Maker. You see, at Melody Maker, it was all very divided, because it was that guy did folk, this guy did jazz, that woman did heavy metal, that woman did pop. I was at that point doing sort of up and coming bands like the Specials, Dexys, Madness, that kind of thing, and soul music, because I love soul music.
Yeah, as I know.
Yeah, that's my...
Your great Northern soul.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
yeah.
A fan,
yeah,
say.
I am a big fan of it. Yeah. So, and it was all, you know, there was, whereas when you got to NME, it was like tribal. It was like I had soul music, and but he was like supporting a football team. He likes indie, you know. It was like, well, he's Arsenal, I'll hate him, you know. He's very, very tribal. But anyway, I worked at the Enemy until 1990.
Obviously, wasn't a roadie, were you?
No.
There goes the mic.
Yeah.
Okay. So following on from there,
yeah,
because I find that at the Enemy they were trying to out critique each other, being quite, you know, who could be the harshest at times.
Well, it was that, and also it was also there was a big intellectual thing.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them being the university, which I hadn't. You know, a lot of them were very, you know, very well read, and there were people from Oxford University, yeah, and you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, it could be slightly anally retentive.
Yes, yeah. So there was a lot of. Yes. It was the Enemy from the '70s was completely different to the Enemy, yeah, from the '80s. You know, but we kind of got into the whole hip hop and acid house thing. I mean, I spent 87, 88, 89 in acid house clubs.
Trying to remember what you did for the last 10 years, were you?
No.
I shouldn't really say that.
Yeah, no, it's true. But
can you still remember those times?
Yeah, I do. I love those times. It was just amazing. And I'd go into the Enemy and say, oh, I've got to write about this guy called Marshall Jefferson. Oh, you can have 500 words. Oh, he's really important. But no one listened, yeah, to me. And it was only when the acid house thing exploded. Yeah. Yeah. I went, oh, that's what you're on about.
Yeah, but blatantly, you were ahead of your time.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. But it's such a vast difference from going from there to your first book, your first...
Well, I left the Enemy, yeah, in 1990, and I got into writing books. So I did, I think the first one was The Small Faces.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Then I did a novel called Heaven's Promise, which was a complete rip-off of Absolute Beginners by Colin McInnes. And then I did, I don't know, books, I just started getting into books. You know, that was kind of
there's,
how...
There's no pee in plagiarism, is, you know, there? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I just got into writing a lot of books, and then it kind of turned out I had three kind of different strands going. So I had music. So I did Small Faces, yeah, Steve Marriott,
that's right,
Oasis, Bowie, The Beatles. Then there was some football stuff. I did Martin Chivers' that's book. Right. I did a book called Football and Fashion. Then I did a book called The Greatest Footballer You Never Saw, which was about this player for Reading called Robin Friday,
right,
who makes Liam Gallagher look like Mother Teresa. He only played, he died of a heroin overdose when he was 39. But he was just this amazing footballer who played for Reading in the fourth division in the 70s, and nobody knew about him except the people at Reading.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd been brought up in a children's home, so I did about two books on that. I did a book called The Looked After Kid, yeah, which was about that experience about being in a home, what had happened to me, blah blah blah. And then I followed that up with a book called But We All Shine On, where I found four of the guys I was in the children's home with, and it was about their experiences. So there's a children's home bit, the music bit, and then the sort of football, yeah, bit.
Do you
and
find
fashion.
It's quite a sort of heartfelt book, that Looked After Kids. It's obviously a very personal thing. How,
yeah,
did you feel,
yeah,
about writing that, or did it help?
Well,
did it help to get it all out?
Well, everybody said that, but, you know. Oh,
you
would
just
it,
wanted to tell your story.
Would it do that? But basically, when I was writing for The Enemy, I mean, I never told anyone about it, right? Yeah. I mean, I never told you, did I?
No, you didn't.
It was only when that book came out. I never told anyone, because the reason I didn't tell anyone was because I didn't want any sympathy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because, yeah, I told a couple of people, and it was like, oh, God, that's terrible. What are you doing for Christmas? Are you okay for Christmas? You know?
No one asked me that.
Which was lovely for people to do. But, you know, and also I didn't want... I wanted to know that I was a good writer. That's why I was employed by him. You know, yeah, I didn't want to think, oh, they've employed me because I'm a kid from a children's home. Because you get very paranoid about that shit, you know.
You didn't want the sympathy.
No, I didn't want the sympathy. I wanted to know I was good at what I was doing. So basically, writing it, it wasn't the writing of it that changed things. It was the publishing of it.
Right.
Because before, I say me, you and Paul are sitting around talking, yeah, and you start talking about your dad and Paul starts talking about his dad, I would either do two things. Either change the subject as quickly as possible or go to the toilet.
Right.
So I wouldn't have to go, well, my dad, because, yeah, I've never met my dad.
Right.
When that book came out, nobody knew really what had happened to me. So everyone's like, oh, my God. But what it meant was that now, because you know about it, because, yeah, Paul knows, yeah, about it, yeah, if you talk about your dad, you talk about your dad, I can say, yeah, but when I was at the children's, yeah, home, we had a guy who was like that or whatever. Yeah. So it was like probably coming out. It was probably like... A coming out thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Save you having to tell loads of people buy
yeah,
a book and
yeah,
just write rather than
and the word had gone round, you know, and people go, oh, I didn't know you were in a children's home. And people, but the best thing about that book, Tom, was that kids who were in care were ringing me up or getting in touch with me, going, "I love this book. This you've summed me up beautifully. You know, this is exactly what we go through." And I was so chuffed that I'd been able to do that, to capture that kind of experience.
Being a writer, obviously, when you look back and you realise there is a story there. Yeah. There isn't, like, it is almost like a film script you couldn't have written. Mm. Like, you'll rise up from that.
The thing is now, I'm really glad I went through it.
Yeah.
People go, "Oh, you were in care." I go, "Yeah, it was great." When I was at Kev, I think about it. There's 25 kids, right, in a big house, right? Mm. We're playing football.
Yeah.
We're trying to snog girls. We're trying to smoke cigarettes behind walls. Yeah. We're a gang. You know, it was like, you know, it was just like a great experience. And I learned all about loyalty, not judging people, you know, loads of good qualities, courage, mm-hmm. you know. Because at 18, they went, "You're out."
That's it.
You're gone. You're on your own. So I learned about courage, determination, perseverance, loyalty, loads of great things.
I suppose in those days it wasn't that much of a support network either, so you were actually...
It was terrible.
You were on your own ego.
I was lucky. I was lucky.
Bus pass, off you go.
Yeah, exactly, man.
Yeah.
And these kids were 16. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just thrown out.
But, you know, it's where you get your strength of character and your perseverance and your focus as well. You could go one way or the other.
Yeah.
You can either let it be your excuse forevermore.
I say in the looked after kid, we either turn out saints or sinners. Do you know what I mean? Why the saints or sinners? Oh, and I'm both.
Should we sit on the fence? I said I like Southampton. I'd be a sinner. Thank you so much. Yeah.
So that was that. And that kind of leads up to this book here, Colour Me Father.
Yeah.
Which is like an open letter to my son, Rafi.
Which that's quite personal. That's personal as well.
Well,
so
Rafi,
gives you a feeling of.
Well, you've got children, right? And you know,
there's nothing better than being a parent.
It's unbelievable.
It's the first time you learn about unconditional love as well. It's the first time when you hold your child and you tell them you love them, and it's not to get them to say it back. It's because you actually
love them.
You just never known to feel that emotion for a human being.
Yeah.
So.
And also, the other thing as well, and I write about it in this book, is that I never knew what a happy childhood was. It was a complete abstraction to me. But watching Rafi having a happy childhood, I'm now getting a happy childhood. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? Because I'm sharing his happy childhood, because I'm part of his happy childhood.
Totally, it makes so much sense. But you can get so much enjoyment.
It's like a mate of mine said to me, he says, "The best therapy you'll ever get." And it's true, because all your insecurities and worries, they go, because now... You're a father now. This is your responsibility. You know, it's not about you anymore. It's about
It's about It's like you learn to put someone else first.
Yeah.
And this is worth $1 million when the child turns around and say they love you. You can't put a price on it.
Yeah.
So
I'll read you something from the book. I'll just read you this. This is what kind of summed it up for me. This bit here. "For many years, Lord, I would walk down the street and think, just give me £1 million. £1 million and all my troubles will be over. Just £1 million. Please, Lord, please. And you refused me, point blank. Instead, you gave me Rafi, a treasure beyond any riches anywhere in this world. I can't thank you enough." That kind of sums it up for me.
Well done.
Thank you.
That was brilliant.
Do you want me to film that?
No, I'll film this bit now. I'll do the reading.
Yeah.
Okay, so. You know, I was very kind of lucky because, you know, working on the music press, I got to meet so many people. I think my favourite thing is that I can say I interviewed the Holy Trinity, which was Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson. You know, I was very, very blessed.
I hate you already. Now you've made me feel inferior. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Bruce Springsteen, hung out with McCartney for a day, you know, blah, 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 you know. It's been, you know, I've been...
Did he make you pay?
Well, you know, come on, Paolo. Come on, just one. There's this great bit. There was the thing in the... When he played the 100 Club, when they were running out of money, and they did a surprise gig to raise money for him. And so he's in between songs, and he goes, "Come on, everybody, we've got to save the 100 Club." And somebody shouts, "Well, you buy it. You got enough money." He goes, "I'll buy it, but you rent it."
What a businessman, eh?
Yeah. It does make me laugh, that boy. But yeah, I've been very, very fortunate to have met, you know, loads of people. I suppose in terms of my books, my two favourite ones are Getting High, The Adventures of Oasis, and All Too Beautiful, The Steve Marriott Story. Those are my two favourite books. That's
one of my favourites as well. Actually.
Oh, really?
Yes, it is.
Oh, thank you. I really like them. The Oasis book, I spent just a year in my flat. Yeah. Every day getting up at...
How long did you spend? Were you on tour with them all?
I went on tour with them.
How did you find that? I bet there was...
Well, in the beginning, it was just fun. In the beginning, it was just fun. I'd go around to see... Noel lived in Camden, you know, and I'd got to know him, and I'd go around and see him to watch the football. And you'd think, okay, I'm going to place A, which is Noel's house. And about 2 days later, I'm in place X, thinking, how on earth did I get here? You know, it was just these things would just happen, you know.
Who am I?
Yeah, where? And getting to know those guys was just great because they were on the way up. Yeah. So everything was new and everything was fresh and they were so excited. Oh, we're going to Japan, wow. We're going to go this, wow. We're doing Oscar, wow. We're doing Nebworth. Then after Nebworth, it kind of got, you know, they put B here, now out, and I think it sold 600,000 copies on the first day. And it just got to be a machine. Yeah. You know, and I went on the Be Here Now tour, and it was a slog, is what it was, because suddenly they weren't, you know, they couldn't mess around like that. You know, they're playing the 100 Club, so they can, you know,
piss around,
you know. But you're playing Wembley Arena to 100,000 people. Yeah. It's a job, you know.
Paolo, can I just ask something?
Yeah, of course.
You were mentioning that books are fighting a bit of a losing battle at the moment.
Yeah.
You've got Netflix. You've got all these streaming visual sites. Can you see that changing, or is that...
It will change, but I mean, the thing is, you've also, the big thing that happened was, of course, Amazon and, you know, the internet, because, like, if you take here in Crouch End, remember Prospero's books?
Yeah.
Well, people would walk into Prospero's and they'd say, a book of mine for $15.99, and they'd go on their phones and they'd go, oh, look, it's on Amazon for $7.99, and they'd buy it there. And the worst thing about Amazon is they take 70%. Which leaves 30% to go to the book publishers, which probably means I get a halfpenny, you know, every time a book sold. So he was, financially, I used to be able to get enough money from an advance to sit at home for 2 years and write my Steve Merritt book or my Oasis book. Yeah. And now it's, you get an advance of £500, you know. So... It's really changed. And also, I think people are, you know, people do what, you know, they're watching Netflix, they're watching Amazon. Trying to get people to read a book these days is quite hard.
It's having the time. It's also sitting there having the time because everything's so fast.
And everyone's so busy now. And, you know, like, yeah, exactly right. I used to just have my nose in a book 8 hours a day and probably now an hour a day because I'm running around doing all these other things.
What about the styles of, for example, you mentioned writing different streets.
Yeah.
Writing music and then writing something personal.
Yeah.
Could you just switch?
Well, the thing was, Paul. What I did was, I'm a huge reader, right? Because I had this really unhappy childhood. I discovered books when I was 5 or 6, and I just got into them because books took me elsewhere, especially like Greek mythology. So it was, you know, the Trojan horse or Hercules. And, you know, I'm not in this horrible place where I'm getting fucking beaten. I'm in this, I'm with Hercules, you know, and we're fighting this and we're, you know, blah, blah, blah. So books and music and football as well just took me into a different space because they put you in the present. You're not worried about the past or the future. If you're playing football, you're in the present.
It's immediate.
So my book reading encompassed people who were writing biographies, music biographies, so I had my favourite writers there, but I'd also read people who'd written their own biographies. So that would kind of influence me when I was writing mine. So I thought, oh, that's how you do it. You can go this way, you can go that way. So you just learn style. You learn different styles, you know. So I could do music, I could do personal, I could do football, you know.
Brilliant. And you're going to do a reading for us?
Yes.
From...
This is my new book. This is called Colour Me Father.
Let me just get this... I'm going to just do a film of you doing that.
Great.
Now, Paolo's going to read an excerpt from his new book, Colour Me Father, and Open Letter to My Son.
Available at www.paolohewitt.com. Only £4.99. You've got to pay three times as much for cigarettes, and this is much healthier for you. Come on, people.
I'll give you a fag and have a copy.
Okay.
All right.
For me, magic is all around. I look up and see the clouds carrying the secrets of the world to unknown destinations. Leaves are words left on the ground for me to read and absorb. Trees are explosion of delight and then delight by leaning into grandeur. Oceans breathe and rivers chitter-chatter, chitter-chatter. Aeroplanes are merely sharks that fly. Einstein again. Strive not to be a success, but to be of value. Or perhaps not, Rafi. Maybe you'll find happiness in that which holds no meaning for me. I play football, you play rugby. I think spiritual, you think materially. Perhaps you will own a house on Bishop's Avenue and its size and grandeur will bring you deep joy. Money may drive you, and you may own banks all over the world. But if you do, be careful. Addiction dwells in money. History counts many brought to their knees by their insistent and monstrous desire for cash. Deep wounds inflicted by the lengths they will go to for its acquisition. Beware the greed money induces, Rafi. Avoid it at all costs, for it will determine and dominate your life to the exclusion of all, including love, freedom and family. And beware fame as well. The majority think it the pinnacle of life, the ultimate achievement. They see it as a panacea for all their problems. I think them wrong. For sure, a tiny percentage of people are suited to fame's demands, its weird rhythms and nature. They wear it well, and maybe you will. But as far as I can see, for many, fame just brings misery. People think it has magical powers, but it doesn't, and it can't, and it won't, and it will never cure the hurt inside. In fact, I think it just adds to it. Or maybe such advice is not at all required for you, Rafi, and you will eschew the world, down all tools, and go to work and live with the poor. Doesn't matter to me, not important. As long as you glow on the inside, that is of the greatest importance to me, Rafi. And that is what I strive to give you in my own small way. Why? Because a man who is in harmony with himself is a man who is in harmony with the world. You can give nothing better to this world than the beauty of your soul, and thus add to the sum of the world's happiness. And it would be difficult to do so. People will come to you and they will resent you, your happiness, simply because they are so deeply unhappy themselves. They are battered and they are bruised. And because of that, they will insult you and trick you and manipulate you and throw punches and break your heart and disappoint you and cause you to cry tears that you never knew were so bitter. And their actions will suggest to you that a life of the spirit is of no value. And maybe they have a point. Maybe this world is godless and a cruel arena. Maybe you are born, we live, we die, and there is nothing else beyond this point. Perhaps my inner journey is a waste of time. That's not the point. I just want you to be aware of all possibilities, Rafi, all roads, and to take the one which speaks to you the deepest without any fear at all of its consequences. I believe that the life of the spirit is far more interesting, endures longer, and offers much more than other illusions and temptations. It's an adventure which never ceases, which offers up new insights every day. I hope you take the road less offered by society. I want you to know all that life has to offer, and I have no doubt you will.
Lovely. Brilliant, Paolo.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
That's great.
Thanks
very much, Paolo.
There you go.
Lyrical Jesse James. Every word, every bit is a bullet, and every lyric is a limb.
Well, you write something like that. I mean, if I write a bit of verse, for example,
yeah,
you go back to it and change it.
Oh, God, you.
Of the words,
oh,
words
bloody hell. It took me a year to write. It's only 20,000. Exactly. You're constantly. It's like a mountain. You're constantly chipping away at it.
Yeah.
The one book I wrote called The Looked After Kid, the beginning bit, right, I spent overall 6 months on. And it's like just a page. But you're constantly going back to it and rewriting it and think, oh, this could be better or that could be better. You know, it drives you mad. And it's never finished. Books are never finished. Because you read it. Like when I was just reading that, I was just thinking, oh, this line could be better. I could do this again. But you have to, at some point, it's like your kids. At some point, you've got to let them go, you know.
It was interesting what you said about your childhood at the library. That really struck a note for me.
Mm?
No, went to the library.
That was great, Jack, guys.
Being in the library at five and reading books.
Yeah. That same year, yeah.
It spoke wonders to me.
Yeah, they really do, don't they?
Oh,
You know, saved my life. Really
they became very sacred to me.
Oh, it did. It
became really good when you were just talking. All of a sudden, it just turned into a lovely conversation.
Nation. Good, good.
You know, lovely. Like you natural, just a conversation. It was really good.
Nice, nice.
Good. Yeah, I love
that. Right.
What am I?